Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economicology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world.
Welcome to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Daniel Pink specializes in books about business. He has one of the most viewed TED Talks of all time, The Science of Motivation, and he adapted it into a best-selling book, Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. Daniel's latest book is When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. He talks this hour with Angie Morgan, founder of LeadStar, which is a consulting firm that helps professionals become better leaders. Before getting into business writing, Daniel was involved in politics. For 2 years, he was the chief speechwriter for Vice President Al Gore. Angie asked Daniel what that was like.
It's a very weird world, and it's not like the world that many people imagine. I mean, we were at something earlier today, and someone was asking me about this and had this view that, you know, those kinds of jobs are these very kind of high-level, exalted, serious jobs, and they're not. The best analogy for being a speechwriter, especially at that level, is working in, say, the emergency room, and your job is to essentially receive the bodies, stitch them up, and hope they don't die on your watch, and then go to the next one. So it's a very demanding job. You're on call all the time, and you're writing on deadline all the time, which can be difficult, and you're writing in service of something else. You basically put yourself second. Your job is to amplify and sharpen someone else's views, which is important, but not what I wanted to do with the rest of my life.
I'd be curious to hear about just your discovery, because I imagine that first book and that first, you know, commitment to writing a book, it's a pretty big decision and it's a pretty big time commitment without guarantee, right, that it's going to get published. What was that process like for you just to make that decision? How did you come up with that idea and that decision to pursue that path?
Yeah, so what happened is like a lot of things in life, and Angie, you mentioned twists and turns, and I try to say this to my kids, and I wrote a book of career advice that includes something like this, and for those, all of you young folks in the crowd, both of you young folks in the crowd, write this down. You know, we have this view that when people do stuff that's reasonably cool, that was always their desire, that was always their goal, that's always what they set out to do. And from the very beginning of time, they set out and marched toward that goal in a steady way. And I've yet to meet anybody who's done that. Instead, what I encourage young people to do is this: find somebody who's doing something super cool and interesting, all right? An ex-Marine with an MBA who's a leadership consultant. That's pretty cool, all right? You know, somebody who's doing something super cool, and ask them, how did you get to be doing this? And I guarantee you, 99 times out of 100, that person will answer that question this way: it's a long story, because it is twists and turns and things like that. So I want to take a step back. Your otherwise simple question, I'm going to give you a long and convoluted answer to.
I love long and convoluted. That's great.
So here's what happened to me. As I said, I'm a Midwesterner. I'm a very hardcore Midwesterner, as oxymoronic as that sounds. I'm a hardcore Midwesterner, and where you grow up, especially in those years, so from basically the time you develop memories, you know, around age 4 or 5, to the time that you are kind of out on your own, I think that it's a pretty formative time. And it's one reason why, especially now that I live on the East Coast, people think I'm incredibly polite, because I say please and thank you, because that's what you're supposed to do, you know? And it's weird if you don't, you know? And so I grew up in the Midwest, very, very middle-class family. My mother was a school teacher and then left that to raise kids. And my father was essentially a kind of like a scientific librarian for a nonprofit, okay? So well-educated people, but like not a wealthy family at all. And my parents always encouraged me to go to law school, probably because they thought I couldn't hack medical school. And the reason for that was they said that was something that you can fall back on. You don't have to go do this. So I heard some like murmurs and amens here at the church in the middle class. But those of you know what I'm talking about, right? Something to fall back on. It was kind of, and so I ended up going to law school without even thinking about going to law school. Like, I didn't even think like that's what I should do. Like, whether it's something I wanted to do. It's like basically that's what I was going to do, because that's what you're supposed to do. In the same way, you're supposed to say please and thank you. And so I got there and I said, holy moly, this is, because I am from Ohio. Holy moly, this is. And I saw what lawyers did, And I worked a summer in a law firm, and I'm like, whoa, I'm not doing this. Like, no one told me. Nobody told me to be like this. And I was very interested in politics at the time, and so I left law school, and I was one of three people in my law school class who graduated unemployed. Law school, for those of you who are lawyers, law school is very much a haven for risk-averse people. And so they like having things, I mean that very seriously, and they like having things lined up well in advance. So people like had like judicial clerkships and legal jobs like lined up like a year in advance or something like that. So I was one of three people in my law school class who graduated unemployed because it was, and it was not great, but it was better than doing something that was certain that I knew I was certain to hate. And so I was interested in politics, and I just took some jobs on campaigns because that's what I was interested in, and I fell into speech writing. It wasn't like I set out to do that. So I didn't say, oh, one day when I grow up, I'm going to become a speechwriter. What happened was something, I think, more relevant, more common in our lives, which is basically this. I had some job, and they said, oh, my God, we need a speech. And whoever had that urge at that time turned around, saw me. I'm actually not kidding, you know? And it's like, oh, this guy is like has a good education. He can probably write a complete sentence. Pink, can you do that? Sure, and one of the things I encourage my kids is to raise your hand. Raise your hand at moments like that. I think it's really important advice. Can anybody here write a speech? You put up your frickin' hand. Whether you can or you cannot, you put up your hand. Because the moment will get you to do that. And so they said, yeah. I said, of course I can write a speech. And I did, and it wasn't awful. Then they asked me again. Then they asked me again. And that became my job.
And you're a speechwriter.
Right, totally. So my point in this very long-winded tale here is that there isn't, like, I think that the way that life unfolds rather than something, than goals so much are pursued, long-term goals at least are pursued, that things just happen. You have to be available at the moment to hear the offer. You have to be available at the moment to respond to it and be true to yourself. So, continuing this incredibly long tale for a very simple question. So I start working in politics, and at first it's really exhilarating because it's kind of exciting. It's like sports, especially campaigns. Like there's winners and losers, and there's a score, and it's over, and you go on to another one, and it's totally cool. And then I ended up being like actually reasonably good at speech writing. And so I kept getting better jobs. And I finally got this job that was a really good job. And I didn't pursue it. It pursued me only because the first choice ended up having to withdraw because of a scandal. But the... True story. And I started doing this, and it was fun at first, but then I started thinking, God, is this really what I want to do? Now, one other tidbit to this, and then we'll get back to it. So, and there is somewhere in here a lesson about life, which is this. So we follow this trajectory here, all right? And it's kind of convoluted. It's not super intentional. It's not about pure long-term goal pursuit. But something else is happening there. From the time I was in a college to the time I was working at these pretty high-pressure jobs, I was always, quote-unquote, writing on the side. What did that mean? I was in college, I majored in linguistics, which is a social science, but a very mathematical kind of social science. And the time that I studied linguistics, it was basically a precursor of cognitive science. So it's a very kind of, you know, serious field. But I ended up entering short story contests in college. Kind of weird, right? In law school, I was writing like newspaper articles and magazine articles. When I went into the workforce, I was still writing newspaper articles and magazine articles. When I had these other jobs, there were certain jobs that I had. I worked as a speechwriter for the then Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich. So, wow, okay, give it up
for
Bob.
Some Reich fans in there.
Wow, okay, so now I know what kind of crowd this is because I think this is the only place east of Berkeley that he would get applause like that. And maybe Cambridge, Mass. And so I was always writing on the side. And I had these jobs at a point where there were federal ethics laws that prevent you from making money outside, perfectly acceptable. But I was still doing it, but not taking the money. And finally, and here, as we move through here, I'm in my early 30s. Let's see. Yeah, I'm in my early 30s. I'm married. I'm in my early 30s, and I'm still doing this. And finally, my wife says to me, hey, this thing you're doing, quote unquote, on the side, late at night, for no money, I think you might like this. You know, I think that might be who you are. So maybe you should go try writing your own stuff. Maybe you are a writer. And it's not something, again, that was pursued. It was something that emerged. And I think that the lessons here, if there are any, for both of you young people out there, is one of them is being awake to the moment, being awake to opportunity, not being too rigid about following a particular prescribed plan, raising your hand, but also more important than anything else is get rid of this stupid question, what's your passion? I freaking hate that question. I think it's a terrible question. I'm on a complete
rant.
Well,
I'm going to not ask one next. Okay, so just so you know, cross that off. So, keep going.
So, because, like, that's a hard question to answer. If you were to ask me that question, Angie, I don't know how I would answer that. How would you answer that? What's your passion?
Well, now I don't know either.
Yeah, right, yeah. No, but I think it's a hard question because I feel like I have to come up with a really good answer to that.
Right,
imagine if you did ask me that. It's like, what's your passion? I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know if I could say after all these years writing, is like, writing is my passion. Because you know what? Writing is really, really hard. It's really hard. The writers in the audience know this. It's really freaking hard. There's some days when I hate it. There's some days when I feel like I'm like climbing up a mountain, you know, uphill with a howling wind blowing at me. And I'm thinking, God, how the hell did I decide to do this for a living? So that's not a sign of passion right there. All right. And so I think the better question on this as we and I think it's true throughout life is we discover things about ourselves by being observers of our behavior and our proclivities. So the better question is, what do you do? What do you do when nobody's watching? What do you do just because you like it? What do you do because it's an expression for you? I discovered after this path where it's like, oh, you should go to law school. Oh, politics is your passion, blah, 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 that there was this discovery that was basically knocking at my door for like 15 years saying, hello, hello, you're a writer. Hello, just wake up, open your eyes. This is what you do. So the answer to your question is yes.
You know, I really like that story better than your 90 seconds, so you're welcome. I like
that. That was like 37 90-second segments.
I thought that was great, though.
Thank you for indulging me.
Well, you know what? You're touching on something, and we'll go back to some of your previous work, too, that I became introduced to your work through Drive, when you looked at the science of motivation and then the artful practices of it, which I thought was very fascinating. So again, so did 24 million plus think the same thing with me, those TED Talk viewers. But I'd love to hear about some of your inspiration for that, because you do talk with Drive about the passion, I'm going to be careful about that word, around getting better at things.
Yeah.
There's something about what we do on the side, you know, we call it our side hustle, but the thing that just captures our imagination that we should pay attention to, because there's
Absolutely.
Some learning in there. So if you could Absolutely. Talk a little bit about Drive and...
Yeah. So that book makes an argument based on a very large body of social science. And to try to distill it as quickly as possible, there's a certain kind of reward we use in organizations. Psychologists call it a controlling contingent reward. That's too cumbersome. I like to call it an if-then reward. As in, if you do this, then you get that. It's the mainstay reward we use in organizations, we use in schools, and so forth. If you do this, then you get that. If you do this, then you get that. And what 50 years of science tells us, because there's a lot of research on this, scholars have been studying this question for half a century, what 50 years of science tells us is that if-then rewards are very effective for simple tasks with short time horizons. They work really, really well. Why is that? Because human beings love rewards. They get our attention. They get our attention in this very fixed, narrow way. So if Anne were up here, you know, if Anne backstage or in the audience somewhere says, oh my God, Dan, you're dying up here. We got to liven this up. I'll give you, if you stand on this table for 3 consecutive minutes on one leg, I'll give you $500. Okay, first, I'm totally there, all right? you laugh, seriously, how many, let's see a show of hands, how many of you would do that? Totally, right? Okay, now, so here's the question. Would you be focused on that or not focused on that? You'd be totally focused on that task, right? You say, where do I put my feet? Where's there a clock? You know, and so if-then rewards are good for those simple kinds of tasks, very kind of algorithmic routine tasks. But if-then rewards are far less effective for tasks that require more judgment, creativity, discernment, conceptual thinking. Because for those kinds of tasks, you want to look widely. You want to have an expansive view, not a narrow view. So if then rewards narrow our focus, that's good for things that where you know what you need to do and you can see the finish line. They're less good for things that require an expansive focus and a longer time horizon. And the problem in organizations is that we tend to use them for everything. And more work, if you look at the economy of Traverse City, you know, it's in some ways it's a microcosm of the shift of routine work to non-routine work. So a better approach based on the science is to pay people well and then offer them a sense of autonomy, so some sovereignty over what they do, how they do it, mastery, which is what Angie's talking about, which is, are you getting better at something that matters? Are you making progress? And then a sense of purpose. Do you know why you're doing something? And it turns out that that recipe is a far more effective recipe for motivation. It's a more difficult recipe to execute than simply dangling carrots in front of people or smashing or threatening them with sticks.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, Daniel Pink talks about how looking and failing to find a book about how to structure his day made him decide to write it himself.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Angie Morgan's conversation with Daniel Pink.
You started off writing your book. Your first book was around free agency, right? Around the gig. It was really a precursor to what we now call the gig economy, this type of employee.
Yeah.
So congratulations being ahead of that.
There's a concept in politics of politicians who are, quote-unquote, ahead of the voters. They don't win.
So you've had more books then. And you wrote, you know, you talked about Johnny Bunko and just some of these other books that you have. But what I find interesting about the body of work that you have is you take theory and you make it practical and relevant for there. And you focus on human performance. And I'd be curious about your interests, because obviously you've been writing on the side. This is a part of your life, your habit, but why human performance? What about that is fascinating? We'll even, you know, transition to talk about your book When too, because to me, it's game changing really when you start to think about how I'm most productive. If I'm most productive, am I most happy? But how did you stumble upon that?
Yeah, I've always been very, very interested in behavior. And if I were not a middle class kid from Central Ohio, I might have gone and gotten a PhD in linguistics or social psychology or something like that. So I was always interested in that. But even more than sort of an earlier stage, I was always very interested in work. Like, what do people, like, I always want to know what people, as a kid, what people did for a living. What was it like to work places? There was a department store in Central Ohio, long gone, called Lazarus. And I remember going there with my parents. It's a kind of, I don't know what the Michigan equivalent of it was. Hudson. Oh yeah, it's not like exactly. It's sort of Hudson's-esque, sort of like a middle brow-ish department store that sold everything, right? Or in Chicago, it was like Marshall Fields. And I remember going there, and I would actually when a counter in a department was unoccupied, I would go behind the counter just to see what would it be like to work in the menswear department at Lazarus, you know, but just for that vantage point. And in even earlier or around the same time, my mother, both of my parents are Chicagoans, as a matter of fact, who got transplanted to Columbus. And my mother brought home a book from the library once in 1974, 1975, called Working by Studs Terkel, who himself is a Chicagoan. And he did these interviews with people, these oral histories with people. And this is a book where he interviewed a bunch of people, what their jobs were like. And my mother brought the book home, I think largely because she was a Chicagoan. Studs Terkel's from Chicago. He had another book called Division Street about Chicagoans who lived along a certain street. And, you know, it's Columbus, Ohio. It's like 1975, all right? And there's nothing to do. So, there's a book lying around. Let me look at it. And that sounds kind of interesting. And so, you know, I'm 10 years old, 11 years old. So I read the excerpt about the baseball player and the prostitute. And and those are interesting, believe me. But then I stayed around, I like read about the taxi driver. What's his job like? What about the nurse? In this case, it was a her. What's her job like? And I just found it, I just sort of found work. I've always found work like totally interesting. Like I like seeing people's offices. I like seeing people's workspaces. I once proposed to my family that we do a family vacation where we go on factory tours around.
How did that go over?
We vote on things, and it was, the vote was 4-1. You know, but I've always thought, so that's actually just sort of a weird long-term fascination of mine. And so if there's a through line in the books, and I don't know whether there is one, it's a lot of it has to do with work. And also a need to marry like the big idea and the practical implications. I don't like books that are like all big ideas. And you're like, holy moly, the world is changing. And then you get to, wait, what am I supposed to do? And the writer's like, oh, no, I don't stoop to that level. And then you have other books that are like, tell you how to do stuff. Like, here's what you should do. Here are the 7 steps. Here are the 4 things. And you're like, okay, how do you know? You're like, are you just making this? Like, and so what I like to do is take the evidence, the facts, the data, the science, but then say, what can we learn from this to apply at the unit of one? Because, you know, ultimately, I think all of us in the world want to have an effect on the world. And so for me, the effect that I want to have as a writer is not purely kind of cognitive for people. Like, I want people, I'm trying to change people's minds and try to entertain them in some ways, but ultimately, I feel better, I stay in the business when I get an email from somebody saying, hey, I read this book and I changed my company's compensation program and now we're doing better than we ever did. Or my daughter wanted to go get an MFA in ceramics. I thought it was a ridiculous idea, but I read your book, A Whole New Mind, and actually that convinced me that she wasn't going to live a life of quiet desperation and poverty. So
you're talking about work and workspaces. Before we get into talk about when, what's your process?
What I do on writing days is the following, because it's so hard to write. I mean, all the writers know that. I mean, there are other things in life that are much, much harder, obviously, but it's hard to write. I mean, I'm not someone for whom, I just don't believe people when they say, oh, I just sit down to write and the words just flow out of my fingers, and, you know. No, is that you?
No, not at all.
No, is that anybody? Anybody here that happens to them? They're already hissing people. You're hissing the person and they haven't even raised their hand. Yeah, no, that's not how it works for me. For me, it's like the cursor is blinking at you, taunting you. What do you got today? You don't have anything, do you? You stink. What do you got today? What do you got today? You can't beat me today. So I'll go to my office at, say, 8:30 or so. And on writing days, what I will do is I will give myself a number of words. It varies with the day, but not a lot. So maybe like 500 words or 700 words or 800 words. And I will write those, say, let's call it 700 words, which is not a massive amount. I will write those 700 words, and I won't do anything else until I hit that number. I won't look at my email. I don't bring my phone with me into the office. So I don't take calls, I don't check my email, I don't obviously don't do any kind of social media. You know, I'll take breaks, but I won't go take a break and like run an errand or do anything like that. I will stay there until I've hit my number. And then once I've hit my number, I'm allowed to do other kinds of things. And so some days, good days, I'll hit my number at 10 o'clock. Other days, 11:30. Other days, 12:30. Other days?
Much later.
Later. And that's what I do. And then I come back the next day and do it again. And then I come back the next day and do it again. Then I come back the next day and do it again.
So it sounds like you're rigid.
Yeah. I think, just to be fair, Angie, I think my process is rigid.
Yes.
I think I'm quite flexible and open-minded, but that's for you to decide. Well, that's how it works for me, and I think it's again, I know, like being here, and you know, this is part of a writer's series, so you've all heard from other writers. I'm always interested in how other writers do things, but my process is not dissimilar from, you know, many others, and I think that in some ways civilians have like this sort of overly elite view of what writing is, and I look at it as essentially, let's say we're a bricklayer. And I were building a wall, what would I do? I would come to the work site, put some bricks up. Then I'd come back the next day, put some more bricks up. I would notice that one brick that I put up yesterday wasn't in the right place, so I would redo that one. Then I'd come back the next day, put up some more bricks. And that's how I think about it. And it's, but if you do 700, 800 words a day, every day, the pages pile up.
It's a book suddenly.
Not suddenly, but soon, eventually, yeah.
Eventually.
Yeah. But it does. And so I have to, because if I were left to my own devices, if I were said, you know what I do? I wake up in the morning and I look at the sky and I listen to the birds chirp, and then I spend the day waiting for inspiration. And the moment that inspiration strikes me, I sit down to write. That wouldn't work for me. I would be penniless.
And I think it'd work for many people.
Yeah, right, yeah. Right.
But it's interesting because I talk about rigidity with your process of writing, of course. And that translates really nice to when, because I'm fascinated by just the thoughts that you have around time and structure in your most recent book, Congratulations.
Thanks.
It was chock full of just so many great ideas. But I'd love to know how you came up with the thought of, there's this book about timing that needs to be written.
Yeah.
And I'd love you to talk a little bit more about that.
I actually wrote two other book proposals before doing this book proposal, the proposal for When, yeah. And I threw them away. I didn't throw them away. I discarded them because I didn't think they were, one of them I didn't think was good enough. One of them I didn't want to spend 2 or 3 years on. You know, it was like an idea, like you have certain ideas and there's some ideas that, you know, you maybe want to go on a date or two with. There are a few you might want to go steady with. And then there are very, very few you want to get married to or be in a long-term relationship with. And this was like, hey, let's go out on a few date kind of idea. And so I had to put it aside and say, it's not you, it's me. Whatever I said.
I think it's a good analogy. Yeah.
But anyway, so this book I said I'd had on my list, and I really was on my list out of frustration because I was making all kinds of timing decisions in my own life. Questions like you're asking, Angie, like when in the day should I do certain kinds of work? When in the day should I exercise? You know, what's a good time to start a new project? When should I abandon a project that's not working? And I was making those decisions in a very, very sloppy way, and I wanted to make them in a better way. And truly, I started looking around for guidance on this, thinking, okay, there's got to be a book on this. And I looked around, and there wasn't. I said, that's weird. And then I said, I wonder if there's any research on this. And it turned out there was a huge amount of research on this. And it was an opportunity for a writer, or at least a writer, a synthesist, because the research was in many, many, many different fields, spread all over the place, and wasn't synthesized or consolidated or analyzed in any coherent way. And what I really wanted to do was, like, this one was very much totally motivated by, like, I wanted to figure it out. That was the big motivation. I want to figure it out. Because I knew that the data, the evidence was there, and I just said, I'm going to try to figure this out.
So when you go through the research, where do you go for the research? Do you go to the experts directly? Do you sit with the computer? How do you find all the data that's available? Because there's a tremendous amount. How do you find it?
It's a great question. It depends. You just sort of follow the trails. There's usually, in certain cases, there's like maybe one or two things I'm familiar with. So I might read, say, an academic. Let me think of a specific example here. Okay, let's take some of the research on endings. Okay, so I have a chapter on endings because our lives are episodic. The episodes have beginnings, they have middles, they have ends, and each of these exerts a different influence on our behavior. And so I was familiar with like one or two papers on, say, endings. And so what I think that I did was say, okay, I know that endings are going to be part of this. Let me go reread or whatever these two papers on endings. Oh, okay, wow, they both seem to be citing this third paper. Let me read that. Huh, I wonder who else has cited that paper. Oh, wow, a lot of people have cited it, and they're citing it in weird ways. Let me look at that. Who wrote that paper? Oh, that person. Maybe I should call her up or email her and ask. And it's just like you follow the trails. And I'm a big collector of stuff. Basically, everything I have is in Dropbox, and I also have giant paper files of stuff that I've accumulated. And so you just kind of just piece it together, and one thing leads to another, and that's why it takes so long.
It's fascinating, though. So when you were writing When, and you're going through the research, what were some of the ideas that just stuck out to you that you thought, oh, this could be game-changing? Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah.
This could even change my life.
Yeah.
And maybe you even had those thoughts.
There were a few. So one of them is, so I start out by writing about the day. I never really thought about time that much. And so you start thinking about time, it's kind of interesting. Like, it was really interesting to read about time, not in the physics sense, because that stuff I had a hard time processing, but in the social sense. So to the point where, like, not that long ago in this country, there were like not, there wasn't a common time. It wasn't until the railroads came along that said, oh, it's important for 12 o'clock in Poughkeepsie to be 12 o'clock in Atlanta. And it, at a certain point, it didn't really matter. Until there were public clocks. This is even earlier, longer ago. For a long time, there wasn't even public time. So there wasn't even a consensus on what time it was. Until there was started, hey, let's put a clock in the central square so everybody is more or less on the same time. That's going to make things more efficient. So you say, wow, this is kind of cool. I've never really thought about any of this kind of stuff. And so I start looking it over. And the thing about the day is a very powerful thing. Because so much of time is, at least, is a human invention, rather than something that's, certain aspects of time are human inventions rather than something that is natural. So if you look at something like a second, okay, we basically decided how long a second is, all right? And so and there's actually a recalculation of that recently. Seriously, at a very sort of micro level. But we could have said a second is this long, or a second is this long. Right, we determined what it was. A week. Who says a week is 7 days? I mean, God, obviously, but who said a week is?
Gotta go far back.
Yeah. Sorry. But you see what I mean? We could have said a week has 8 days, and everyone would say, "Oh, a week has 8 days." But if you think about a day, that's a real thing, right? You can't do anything about that. You just can't declare, "Oh, I decided that a day is better at being 22 hours." You're going to be, you know, it's not going to work. Because of the planet. So the day ends up having a big influence. And the big takeaway for me on the research on the day, and I was really surprised by it, was how much our brain power and our abilities change over the course of a day. Our brain power doesn't remain static over the course of a day. It changes in pretty significant ways. And performance varies considerably based on time of day. I was surprised by both the depth of the research and its implications. One other thing is that I started out writing about the day, and I said, well, let me check about breaks. Let me look at the research on breaks. And I was going to write one or two pages on breaks, and I started looking at the research on breaks, and it was blown away by the science of breaks to the point where it basically became a new separate chapter, because the research was so surprising and so interesting, and I think potentially so useful.
I'd love to talk about that, and I'm going to introduce one of the favorite topics or brandings that you have is the Nappuccino. Oh, yeah. Can you talk about the Nappuccino? Because that's kind of changed my life.
Oh, good. So in the chapter on breaks, I do write about naps. I was curious about naps. And I was always someone, I was never a nap fan. I was a nap, what's the opposite of fan? Nap?
Hater.
Okay, yeah. I was a nap hater. I would occasionally take naps, and when I woke up, I would always feel terrible. I mean, not only kind of groggy and you know, cobwebbed in my mind, but also like a little ashamed of myself. And so I started doing the research on naps, and it turns out that naps are really good for us. There's a lot of research on naps. Naps are really good for us, but what's surprising is that the ideal nap is incredibly short. It's between 10 and 20 minutes long, which never occurred to me that would be like a length of a nap, right? And so that nap nap shorter than 10 minutes, you don't get much of the benefit. You nap longer than 20 minutes, you begin to develop what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling you get from when you wake up from a nap. But that 10 to 20 minute nap gives you the benefits, essentially the phrase that I like, which Michiganders will understand, nobody south of the Mason-Dixon line does, is that naps are Zambonis for your brain. So, did not translate well to the Italian. They're like a Zamboni. I like the metaphor, because you have all these like scuffs and nicks on your ice, and a nap can just come over and you go smooth them all out. But the ideal nap, which Angie's mentioning, is actually something that I do, which is, and there's some really interesting papers on this where I'll tell you my practice. So I will, on my phone, set the timer for 25 minutes, countdown timer for 25 minutes. Right before that, right before I hit go on the timer, I will have a cup of coffee. I will just down a cup of coffee. I won't enjoy it. I'll literally brew a cup of coffee. Honestly, I'll brew a cup of coffee, but then I'll plunk some ice cubes in it and just guzzle it, all right? And so, stick with me. So I'll put my timer on for 25 minutes, and I have noise-canceling headphones, and I have a chair in my office. And so I'll sit in my chair, and I have an ottoman, so I'll sit in my chair, and I'll put on my noise-canceling headphones, and I'll click that. And I can usually fall asleep in, say, you know, 10 minutes. And so I fall asleep in 10 minutes, and then the alarm goes off in 25 minutes. So I've napped for 15 minutes, roughly, which is right in the sweet spot. So I've got the nap without sleep inertia. But then remember that cup of coffee. It takes about 25 minutes for the caffeine to get into your bloodstream. So when you wake up, you get that added hit of caffeine. And this is what's known in the literature, as Angie said, as a nappuccino.
Thank you for that.
And I've gotten a lot of email on. Thanks. I've gotten a lot of emails on nappuccinos. Seriously, from people saying, one, this is how I got through graduate school, and other people saying, this is how I got through the military. Okay. I've got a lot of people in the armed forces emailing me saying, yeah, this is how I made it. Like, it's so exhausting, but I was able to do this thing, and I thought I was the only one who did this.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up, more of Angie Morgan's conversation with Daniel Pink.
Listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Doug Stanton. Let's return to Angie Morgan's conversation with Daniel Pink.
So you wrote about the nappuccino and the, you know, physical sleep break. What else, though? Because a lot of professionals are in the audience.
Yeah.
What are we doing wrong to not maximize our time or our decision-making power in regards to breaks in the workspace?
Yeah, that's a really good way to frame the question, too. It's like, what are we doing wrong? Because I think that's really at the heart of it. And it's this. What we're doing wrong with regard to breaks is this. We're thinking of breaks as a deviation from performance rather than part of performance. Right? Breaks are part of our performance. Breaks are integral to our performance. They're not a concession. They're not a deviation. They're not a detour. They're part of our performance. They help us perform better. It's true physically, and it's certainly true cognitively. And what we know from this research is we should be taking more breaks in the day, and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks, that not all breaks are created equal. And what we know from this research is some really interesting stuff. We know that for breaks, something is better than nothing. So literally taking a one-minute break can be helpful in restoring physical energy and even mental acuity. So we know that something beats nothing. We know when it comes to breaks, I found this interesting, is that social breaks are more restorative than solo breaks. That is, breaks with other people are more restorative than breaks on their own. And they've actually tested this. This is true even for introverts, that introverts are more restored with breaks with other people as well.
Wow.
Yeah, I was surprised by that. I was a little disappointed. But it's interesting. So breaks with other people, we know, and this is fairly well known, especially in a community like this, that breaks where you're moving are better than breaks where you're stationary. I think that's becoming more widely known. One thing that's amazing, and I think it's something that's underreported in the popular literature, is the restorative effects of being in nature. That breaks outside are more restorative than breaks inside. There are powerful effects of spending time outdoors in greenery, by beautiful bodies of water, etc. I mean, for our mental health, even for our physical health. This is a really, really interesting area of research. I think it's underreported. And we know that breaks that are fully detached are better than breaks that are semi-detached. So you really have to take a break. You can't just, I'm going to take a walk outside and look at my phone. Or even things like talking about work with a colleague at break. Like, something to be said for not talking about work. And so we put this all together, there is a sort of platonic ideal of a break, which is that take a 15-minute walk outside with someone you like, without your phone, talking about something other than work. And that's a performance enhancer. And it's not like people say, oh, I can't do that, it's too expensive, I don't have the budget for that. Yeah, I mean, truly, I think that if every American did that once or twice an afternoon, you would see improvements in mental health and improvements in productivity. And I mean that very seriously, to the point where I will often on a day, I will schedule a walk break, literally put it on my calendar, 3:15, walk break. And I will take, I live in a residential neighborhood, and I'll just take a walk around, you know, a lot of trees and things. I will take a walk around my neighborhood.
That sounds like a practice, right? I think many of us can all
It's simple, but you know, again, I think we tend to poo-poo these kinds of things. And this is not a, like a namby-pamby thing saying, oh, we would all be more spiritually awakened if we spent time in nature. That might be true. I don't know. I'm agnostic on that. But what I do know is the research says we should be taking more breaks, that our performance will increase if we take more breaks, and that if we take the right kinds of breaks, our performance will increase even more. This is even true for children. All right? Think about this. Think about this set of design principles that I just laid out. Outside with someone you like, moving around, fully detached. What does that sound like? Totally, right? You know, and so, and what you have now, unfortunately, in certain school districts, is you have, in the name of rigor, canceling recess. You know, well, we got to get rid of recess in order to be rigorous and turn our kids into high performers, when the science says that's wrong. Like, to your question, Angie, truly, that goes directly to Angie's question. What are we thinking about wrong? And that's a good example of what are we thinking about wrong. And there's some interesting research out of some low-income districts in Texas showing that actually a way to raise test scores, particularly among low-income kids, is to add recess. There's a fascinating piece of research out of Denmark, where in Denmark, students take standardized tests, as they do here in the States. In Denmark, they take the tests on computers rather than on bubble forms. But the typical Danish school has more students than computers, so everybody can't take the test at the same time on test day. So the students are randomly assigned to take the test at different times of day. Some take them early, some take them late. And it turns out, this amazing piece of research from Francesca Gino at Harvard and two Danish researchers, that kids who take standardized tests in the afternoon score as if they missed 2 weeks of school. Yeah, it's crazy, right? I mean, it's crazy, and yet the remedy for that is they're like, whoa, this is a big deal. To me, it's one of the many things that calls into question standardized tests as the central policymaking tool in education policy. It's like, whoa, that's kind of a flaw, guys. Maybe we need to think about that. But what they did in Denmark based on this is they said, well, what can we do? Because we truly can't have everybody taking we don't have the resources to have everybody taking the test in the morning. And I think for like security reasons or whatever, they want everyone to take it on the same day. So they didn't want to take it on sequential days. And they said, let's try this. Let's give kids, before the afternoon test, 20 to 30 minutes to have a snack and run around outside. Scores go back up. That's why your question is perfectly phrased. Like, we're thinking about it wrong.
Well, in the implications, and that was one of the things that I took away from your book, like the implications of poor timing or poor structuring of your life or poor decision making. I'd love for you to talk about some of the medical implications, because I think that affects everyone, regardless of your health status whatsoever. So what did you learn in the research about when to schedule doctor's appointments, when to schedule emergencies, colonoscopies, all those fun things that you were talking about in your work? You don't have to go into detail, but just...
I mean, what I learned, the top level view, Angie, what I learned is no one in the Pink family is allowed to go to a discretionary hospital visit or an important doctor appointment in the afternoon under any circumstances, period. And seriously, don't go to the hospital in the afternoon if you can avoid it. The research is overwhelming here. I mean, it's really overwhelming. Let's take anesthesia errors. Anesthesia errors 4 times more likely at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. You look at hand washing in hospitals. So big problem in this country, huge problem in this country of hospital-acquired infections. People go to the hospital without an infection. They get an infection in the hospital. This is a multi-billion dollar problem, costs thousands of lives every year. The first line of defense is for people working in hospitals to wash their hands. Hand washing in hospitals is surprisingly not high. But if you look at it over, this is the work, a really nice paper from Katie Milkman at Penn and two other researchers at University of Pennsylvania. Hand washing in hospitals plotted against time looks like this. Massive drop off in hand washing in hospitals in the afternoons. If you look at individual doctor behavior, the prescribing of unnecessary antibiotics way higher in afternoon appointments. And that's obviously a serious public health issue because overprescribing antibiotics creates superbugs. Another public health problem, opioids. Doctors prescribe opioids more in afternoon appointments than they do in morning appointments. If you look at, thank you for the invitation, Angie. I welcome the opportunity to discuss my colonoscopy with 400 strangers. I had a colonoscopy in October, and did we bring pictures? No, we didn't bring pictures. But I scheduled it for 9 a.m. because there's research showing that doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams for the same population. So there are, and this is a big deal. And I think what's interesting is that, you know, we talk about education, we can talk about healthcare, we can talk about jury decision making, we can talk about certain kinds of corporate performance, basically any domain. What you see is that there are differences in performance based on time of day, that not all times of day are created equal. And the premise in how we organize our work is that our cognitive abilities are pretty much constant. So it doesn't matter if you have the test at 9 versus 2. It doesn't matter if we have this meeting at 11 a.m. or 4:30 p.m. It does. And the implications for schools are actually like really, really serious. So for instance, elementary school students, one more study, there's a really great study of the L.A. Unified School District, where they took anonymized, so we don't know who the kid is, but 2 million student profiles of elementary school students and looked at when they had math class, and then what their grades were and how they performed on statewide standardized tests. And it was unequivocal that kids who had math in the morning learned more math, period, full stop. And so if you think about it at the level of a school, you know, among the many things that educators have to deal with, it's like scheduling is not merely a logistical issue. Like if I'm running a school, all my students to have math in the morning based on this research. It's not fair to kids having math at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
You brought something to read, or we bookmarked something that you can read. I was fascinated by this research as well. Do you mind putting it in context? And
sure. This is on a chapter on group synchronization. How do groups synchronize in time? And the chapter is called Syncing Fast and Slow. Exercise is one of the few activities in life that is indisputably good for us, an undertaking that extends enormous benefits but extracts few costs. Exercise helps us live longer. It fends off heart disease and diabetes. It reduces our weight and improves our strength. And its psychological value is enormous. For people suffering from depression, it can be just as effective as medication. For healthy people, it's an instant and long-lasting mood booster. Anyone who examines the science of exercise reaches the same conclusion. People would be silly not to do it. Choral singing might be the new exercise. The research on the benefits of singing in groups is stunning. Choral singing calms heart rates and boosts endorphin levels. It improves lung function. It increases pain thresholds and reduces the need for pain medication. It even alleviates symptoms of irritable bowel syndrome. The first time I've ever said those words aloud. Group singing, not just performances, but also practices, increases the production of immunoglobulin, making it easier to fight infections. In fact, cancer patients who sing in choirs show an improved immune response after just one rehearsal.
How did you discover that? I mean, that obviously was a trail that you followed to get to that point.
Well,
that's fascinating.
Yeah, thanks. What I did is that I started looking for domains in which I was really interested in how groups synchronize. And there's a line from, it's a very, very popular book. Let me see if I can find this. Maybe he's even been here. I don't know. But the fellow who wrote the book, The Boys in the Boat, very popular book. So it's a book about the 9-person crew team from the University of Washington that won the gold medal at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And he says, this is Daniel James Brown, he said, and he came to understand how those almost mystical bonds of trust and affection, if nurtured correctly, might lift a crew above the ordinary sphere, transport it to a place where nine boys somehow became one thing, a thing that could not quite be defined, a thing that was so in tune with the water and the earth and the sky above that as they rowed, this is the line that I love, effort was replaced by ecstasy. I found that very compelling, and I started thinking about what are the things that people do to, you know, like, in sync with the other people. And so I ended up spending some time with a choral group because I had gotten wind from one scholar about, hey, you should check out the research on choral singing. Because when I'm working on something, I often like to talk about it with people. What are you working on? And I'll say, here's, I'm working on X, Y, and Z. And sometimes people will say, that's interesting. Or they'll change the topic or whatever. But what I really like is, oh, that's interesting. Have you thought about such and such? And I had a conversation, hey, you should check out the stuff on choral singing. Just look at the research on choral singing. I think there might be something there. And when I saw it, it's like, whoa! It was kind of amazing. So it was a case of like sort of looking for the right domains and then finding things. And there's a lot of good research on rowing too. So when you look at like pain thresholds, if you think about rowing, you know, you can analyze the motion in like the physics sense. You can look at how much energy and effort is being expended, right? There are physical properties of that. But when you ask people to report their pain at doing this very difficult thing, for the exact same motion, the exact same physical exertion, people will report less pain when they do the exact same motion in group rowing than in individual rowing. And that's kind of amazing. You know, there's something about the synchronization that is just really, really incredible. And so I got there in sort of like a roundabout way, basically talking to somebody else, gave me a tip. I'd been interested in rowing in part because I had read that and thought, wow, that's so amazing. Like, what does it feel like to do that? And that's how I got there.
And that is why I think not just me, but many people in the audience, too, really appreciate your work. You take these ideas and this research and you pull it and you make it practical, because I think that's the takeaway. I mean, we all want to get better Absolutely. At something. We all want to maximize our time. We want to feel good about the work we're doing. And that is what I think your work helps Thanks. Us all do. And so I just want to thank you, Dan, for your time Thank tonight. You. And please, for everyone here tonight, Dan's got his books outside.
Yeah, I will not leave Traverse City until the final book is sold.
Until all the final books are sold. But ladies and gentlemen, join me in the round of applause. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for coming.
That was Daniel Pink talking with Angie Morgan. Daniel Pink's latest book is called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Support for the National Writers Series is brought to you by the Wege Foundation, dedicated to developing leaders in economic ecology, health, education, and arts, and enhancing the lives of people in West Michigan and around the world. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlockinpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.